Crop rotation is the planting. I'll step back. So commercial vegetable growing involves what's called crop rotation, doesn't it? And the idea behind that is you plant different crops,
yes,
over multiple years.
Yes, I'm sorry, I'm not an expert in commercial vegetable production.
No, but you understand that the water quality effects measuring are relating to this feature, which is called crop rotation, right?
Yes.
And part of that rotating process involves going across land parcels, potentially, doesn't it?
That's my understanding, yes.
Yes, and it often includes a pasture phase where you're not growing vegetables on a particular plot, right?
Yes. Is that called the fallow?
Yes, and you understand that one reason that crop rotation is undertaken is for the purpose of maintaining nutrients in the soil.
Yes, so to allow the soil time to recover?
Yes, and that's because different vegetable crops might have a different drawing different nutrients from the soil and depositing different things in it.
And also for disease management.
Yes, so rotating crops is important for disease management too, isn't it? And also for reducing soil erosion.
Yes, so particularly when you have land cover like grass, you'll have lower erosion than bare soil.
And are you aware, at least in a general way, that for Plan Change 1, there's a debate or discussion about whether that rotation should be allowed at a subcatchment level or a FMU level?
Yes, I'm aware of that.
Yes. And so and there's around, and there's far fewer FMUs than subcatchments, right?
That's right.
In the whole area, does sound about right, there's about 8 FMUs in total and about 74 subcatchments. So you can see that depending on whether the court decides rotation has to be limited to subcatchments or the bigger FMU areas, that will have a significant effect on how commercial vegetable production is able to operate.
Yes, it comes down to the level of constraints, yes.
Yes. And am I right in summarising that your particular focus is, or one of them, is on whether providing for crop rotation at that bigger FMU scale, whether that would result in the net changes, for instance, in nitrogen load? That's one thing you've looked into.
Yes, insofar as if commercial vegetable production moved into an area, albeit perhaps on a temporary or rotational basis, if commercial vegetable production is using or potentially losing more nitrogen than the existing land use, in that local area at that time, nitrogen loss, the risk of nitrogen loss is greater under commercial vegetable production in that locality.
And that, you're saying that specifically the situation where CVP is expanding into somewhere it hasn't been before. Is that right?
That's correct. So, or even if you're thinking of it, let's say on an annual basis, if commercial vegetable production moved onto a parcel of land as part of a rotation, where that parcel of land was previously in a lower nitrogen loss land use, then over that period under commercial vegetable production, that parcel of land is likely to have an increased risk of nitrogen loss.
But I understand that saying that applies for the time scale of, say, a year, but what about over the medium to long term? Is it right that in that situation, rotating at the FMU scale would result in no net change in nitrogen load?
So at the FMU scale, all else being equal,
yes.
So there's no expansion,
yes.
So all land uses use the same area, then yes, you would expect the sort of total nitrogen loss to be similar at the FMU scale.
Yes, or at the subcatchment scale.
At the subcatchment scale, in my opinion, there is likely to be some concentration of commercial vegetable production in the highest capability class land, but that tends to be the areas where commercial vegetable production becomes concentrated. And so over the longer term, areas where commercial vegetable production becomes concentrated may result in increased nitrogen and possibly other contaminant losses at the subcatchment scale, if that subcatchment is the focal point of concentrated commercial vegetable production.
And I understand what you're saying now, but if you got that joint witness statement on water quality in front of you,
yes.
Can you go to question 49, please?
Yes, I have.
And you participated in the conference and on this question?
Yes.
And wasn't it something you agreed to that you expect that providing for crop rotation at the FMU scale would result in no net change in N load at FMU or subcatchment scale over the medium to long time scale?
Wasn't that
your evidence?
So that's correct, and that's what we were just covering in terms of the FMU scale. We're going to say that, and certainly point two was one I proposed and everyone agreed to, which is that
yes. There
is potential for localised impacts associated with concentration of CVP in certain areas if that concentration occurred at the FMU scale.
Yes, well, we'll get to point two, but just in terms of point one, it's still your evidence today, isn't it, that at either the FMU or subcatchment scale over the medium to long term, there isn't going to be a net change in N load?
All else being equal, yes. So if
the
total areas of different land uses stay the same.
Yes, and then I hear what you're saying, that, well, there's still point two, which is there's potential for localised impacts associated with concentration of CVP in certain areas. That's a fair summary of your concern or your caveat, isn't
yes.
it?
Primarily because commercial vegetable production does tend to become concentrated in certain soil types and climates.
Right, so is your reference to, or the group's reference to, in certain areas, are you meaning the areas where there might be an intense amount of CVP happening?
Yes. So, as we've discussed, if commercial vegetable production moved around within an FMU but was concentrated in certain areas of really good quality soils, good climate conditions, etc., good rainfall, then there is that potential for localised impacts of a more intense land use.
Yes, and localised impacts are at the scale down even from subcatchment level, aren't they?
It's entirely possible that concentration will be picked up in some of our monitoring sites throughout the catchment. So some of those sub-catchments, so that they have monitoring sites associated with them, if there was concentration of CDP in the medium to long term in that sub-catchment, mm-hmm. which hadn't previously been there, I would expect to be able to detect that in the monitoring site in terms of increased potentially nitrogen, possibly also sediment increases.
And that's something the council, with its monitoring, would be keeping an eye on, isn't it?
Yes, because under PC1, obviously we have a maintain or improve, so every one of those monitoring sites, there's a requirement to at least maintain, if not improve.
And there'd also be a requirement for the grower, wouldn't there, to keep track of those sort of changes, for example, through the FEPs?
Yes, and that information would be really useful in trying to interpret what we see in the water quality monitoring data.
Yeah, and the FEPs are reviewed or updated over time, aren't they?
That's my understanding, yes.
Yeah, as a grower, you wouldn't just put it in your bottom cupboard and carry on as you were, would you?
No, my understanding would be a living document and active.
Yeah. So if it turned out that there were these localised effects in particular certain areas, is it fair to say that could be that's likely to be identified without too much trouble?
Yes, and in relation to the medium to longer term, the MPSFM requires us to put in place action plans when degrading trends are observed. So from the starting point of the regional plan, if we identify further degrading trends, we would then work to implement an action plan to address that.
Yes, so you're saying the action plan is another tool in the council's belt to keep these potential effects under control?
Yes.
And your concern about the localised impacts, you've said in number two there that it's a potential for localised impacts, right?
Yes.
And is that, for that potential and these certain areas, that wasn't the subject of any detailed water quality modelling that you undertook?
No.
Are you aware that one of Horticulture NZ's witnesses has devised a risk scorecard? Are you aware of that?
I'm aware. I haven't looked at it.
Okay. In terms of commercial vegetable production expanding into new areas that it hasn't been before, your evidence is that that's likely to increase concentrations of contaminants unless there are appropriate mitigations in place, isn't it?
Yes.
And that's your concern, even though you accept, don't you, that the overall increase appears small at the catchment scale.
I think in the technical caucusing there was a reasonable level of comfort that the modelling undertaken on behalf of Horticulture New Zealand does indicate increases in nitrogen. There's always going to be some uncertainty about the scale of those increases and whether they are small or not small is a bit more subjective.
Well, the modelling you're referring to identified, didn't it, that it would be an increase of about 0.5% in the total nitrogen load.
In the lower Waikato River.
Yes, and that half a percent increase was assuming that commercial vegetable production increases by about 1,800 hectares.
Yes. Yep. We also talked about to what extent that increase might be mitigated by grower management practices.
Yes.
So to reduce that risk or reduce that increase. And I think that comes back to my earlier point, which is that increase in commercial vegetable production is likely to increase the levels of contaminants unless they are appropriately mitigated by the growers.
Yes. And the mitigations that are available, they include, don't they, things like the FEPs that we just chatted about a moment ago.
So the FEPs themselves aren't the mitigations, it's the changes in grower practice. So perhaps providing catch crops, providing more efficient use of nitrogen fertiliser. Those are the sorts of actions that we would expect to see in those farm plants, and those are the actions that would be the appropriate mitigations.
Yes, but you'd reasonably expect, wouldn't you, that if there are requirements to do those sort of things in the FEP, and you need an FEP to continue to enjoy the resource activity status, a prudent grower would strive to comply with those requirements.
Yes, and I think that's the outcome we're looking for with farm environment plans throughout the country, really, that voluntary action on behalf of growers and farmers.
Mm. And so aren't those voluntary actions backed up by sanction or the loss of their resource activity status? Isn't that an adequate set of mitigations together with the things you've discussed? Isn't that adequate?
I'd perhaps direct that to Mr. Trevilco, but I think to my initial point is if you're looking to intensify land use, you are increasing the risk of loss of contaminants, and in commercial vegetable production that's primarily going to be around nitrogen and sediment. So there's that risk has to be dealt with appropriately.
Yes.
And one of the ways you can do that is through requiring different levels of control on the growers and requiring different actions from them.
Yes. And I hear what you're saying, and that mitigations are important. But if we can zoom out and try and think about the overall risk level posed by CVP, you're aware that the total area of commercial vegetable production is just 0.6% of the total area of the Waikato River catchment, aren't you? You're aware of that?
I haven't done that maths. How many hectares is that?
But does that sound about right to you? Less than 1% of the total area that we're talking about in PC1 is...
I don't know the exact numbers. Commercial vegetable production makes up a very small fraction of total land area in the PC1 area.
Yeah, and a very small fraction of the total diffuse nitrogen load too.
At the whole of catchment scale, there are sub-catchments where commercial vegetable production has a significant contribution to levels of nitrogen and sediment.
But overall, would it surprise you if it was just 2.5% of the total nitrogen load?
That wouldn't surprise me, no. As measured at the Waikato River at Tuakau.
And similar for phosphorus, you wouldn't be surprised if it was just 0.9% of the diffuse total phosphorus load at that overall catchment scale. So, I know you'd earlier questioned the objectivity or subjectivity of that modelling undertaken by a horticulture NZ expert. You remember this is his calculations that if CVP were to expand by the total amount that he says is required, about 1,800 hectares, that was him saying, well, I think there'd be a total 0.5% increase. So is that what you're saying?
I think there was a question
its objectivity.
There was reasonable comfort in the methodology used.
Mm-hmm.
As far as we were aware, that methodology was appropriate.
Mm.
What was, I guess, more subjective is, you know, whether that's a small or, in other words, a negligible or a inconsequential increase. Mm. That's not necessarily our science. That's not science terminology. It's more, yes, the modelling shows an increase in nitrogen in the river as a whole. The extent to which there is likely to be an increase is going to be uncertain due to the modelling work, and whether that increase should be considered small or inconsequential is reasonably subjective.
But you're aware that the results of the modelling weren't just limited to that single figure, 0.5%. Aren't you?
Sorry, can you explain?
But it wasn't just the one figure that was plucked out. What was it?
No, I think, yeah. So, as I say, there was reasonable confidence amongst the technical experts that the modelling methodology was appropriate.
And it included analysis for sub-areas of the Waikato River, didn't it?
Yes, that's my understanding.
So for the upper Waikato FMU, the increase was about 0.1%, wasn't it?
That's my understanding, yes.
And then for the lower Waikato, it was about 1.7% increase. And then wasn't that the basis of saying on average 0.5% of an increase overall? If CVP were to expand by that maximum amount.
I wasn't aware of that. So you're saying that the increase in the lower Waikato is an additional 1.7% of the nitrogen load, but above Karapiro it was 0.1%, and so averaging that. Sorry.
And, well, I'm asking you if you're aware that the modelling included analysis for parts of the river.
Yes.
And you are?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well,
but are you saying, well, figures like 0.1, 0.5, 1.7, that you couldn't you couldn't responsibly say whether that's negligible or not. Is that your evidence?
That would be my view, yes. I mean, if you consider the nitrogen load in the Waikato River, and that's a very, very large number. And so an increase on that, and if I may say it in relation to the targets set for the river, that's an increase, likely to lead to an increase in non-achievement of those targets.
And do you say that because your view is that, well, if we're planting it in commercial vegetable growing land, well then that land isn't contributing to the overall reductions required to meet those targets? Is that what you're getting at there?
Yes, if I may, the targets that are set for the Waikato Waipa are such that there is, and I think this came out earlier in the joint witness statement for water quality, is that there is no headroom, so to speak. If you're looking at maintaining or improving, then an increase in contaminants, regardless of the scale of that increase, is not consistent with those targets.
And so you're saying that, do you feel able to give evidence that, you know, a less than 1% increase should receive the same regulatory response as much, much larger increases from other land users? Is that what you're giving evidence about, is it?
Yeah, I guess I'd feel if we are seeking to maintain or improve, and yet we know that there is a proposal to increase contaminant loss, which and with the modelling, well, the modelling is appropriate. There's uncertainty about the extent of those numbers, so they're likely to be, you know, there'll be errors or, you know, uncertain estimates around those numbers. So I guess what we can be certain about is the modelling indicates an increase in nitrogen load in the river. The extent of the increase in nitrogen load is more uncertain. And it's not, I don't think it's for scientists to say whether a 0.1% or 1% or a 10% is acceptable or not acceptable.
I understand what you're saying about the word acceptable, because that might be the decision for others in the courtroom today, but surely in terms of descriptive words like negligible, that is something within the purview of a scientist like yourself, isn't it?
In terms of, yeah, if we were talking about effects.
Yeah.
So would the effect of an increase in total nitrogen load of, let's say, 0.1%,
yeah,
would we consider that negligible?
Mm.
So well, in a system that is already considered degraded, it becomes more degraded. Even it might be becoming more degraded by a negligible amount, but it's becoming more degraded. What we are seeking is, and Te Tūri Whaimana sort of directs us towards, is long-term improvement. So the effect of contaminant inputs is that the river is considered to be degraded and is not meeting its community-defined targets.
Yes, but it's a question of degree, isn't it?
I don't think it is. If it's currently degraded and there's a proposal to make it more degraded, I'm not sure if that is a question of degree.
So, from your perspective, if the modelling had come back and said, actually, expanding CVP is going to have a 100% degradation on the quality of the water in the river, would you be saying today, that's of no greater concern to me whatsoever? Seriously?
Well, seriously, that's not a viable scenario. You're not going to increase the nitrogen load in the river by 100% through CVP expansion. That's not a reasonable scenario.
But if there was some... But can you at least for the moment imagine if the modelling had come back with some number, an order of magnitude or two, bigger than the amounts we're talking about here, would you really be saying it's all the same to me in terms of water quality?
I think the... What the modelling does indicate is that if growers can put appropriate mitigations in place, and this is why, as technical experts, we were considering or looking to Horticulture New Zealand to try and understand what degree of mitigation might be possible, is if there was, let's say, a 1% increase associated with commercial vegetable production, that could well be covered by mitigation activities. If the increase was more on the order of 10% or 20%, that really does suggest that those increases could not be fully mitigated. So there is those two elements. One is there is an increase in contaminant loads in the river, but an unknown extent to which growers could mitigate that through changes in practice.
So to answer my question then, it actually does make a difference if you know whether we're talking about a 0.1% increase in nitrogen or a 10% or more. It does make a difference.
So if the river's going to become more degraded,
yep.
But growers can put in place mitigations to reduce that.
Yep.
Then my understanding is that PC1 allows for expansion, allows for intensification.
But I guess in terms of water quality, which is what your area of expertise is, isn't the amount of additional degradation quite properly a relevant factor that goes into deciding what the water quality effects will be?
So the effect of increasing contaminant levels is the failure to meet the targets, and those targets are set in place primarily to protect or to provide outcomes for values around both contact recreation and ecosystem health in the case of PC1. So is it
a relevant factor that goes into the mix or not? The degree of additional...
I guess what I'm saying is that any increase,
yes,
is having an effect because it's leading to the non-achievement of the targets.
Sure, but it's relevant, isn't it, that it's not the same amount of effect as a 10% increase or whatever.
Yeah, I can accept that it's a 0.1% increase is less than a 10% increase.
Well, and it's less bad for water quality than a 10% increase, isn't it?
No, because and not in those terms, because when we seek to assess the effectiveness of PC1, we'll be assessing whether we've achieved the targets or not. And in my view, there is a simple pass-fail test there. So will we achieve the targets? Whether we have not achieved the targets by 0.1 or 10%, it's not necessarily meaningful. We've failed to achieve our target, and we would need to understand why we've failed to achieve the target.
Yep, and I understand your philosophy from a planning or regulatory perspective, but I guess from a simply water quality science perspective, isn't it pretty obvious that a 0.1% increase in nitrogen is less bad for water quality than a 10, 20, 50% increase?
I can accept that in cases where targets haven't been set.
Mm.
Where targets have been set, if you fail to achieve that target,
yes,
it's a fail, regardless of whether you fail by 1% or 10%.
Yes, but in terms of the science of water quality, there is a difference, isn't there?
What the ecological effects,
yeah,
of an increased nitrogen load might be. Yes, I mean, we could look at that, but in reality we have, under the NPSFM, we've set targets.
I understand that. Like,
and it will be held to account as to whether we've achieved or, yep, not achieved those.
Yep, no, I understand that, what you're saying from that regulatory perspective, but
But
if I can ask you about the other part of your concern, which I understand is, in crude terms, CVP, expanding CVP means it's not playing its part for the overall reduction. That's not quite right, is it? If the area that CVP is going into for the first time is replacing a more intensive land use.
That's right, yes. So if there's a lower nutrient or sediment loss associated with commercial vegetable production moving into an area,
yes,
then yes, that would have potential local benefits.
Mm. And could an example be, for example, moving into a dairy farming land use, if CVP were to expand into that sort of area? Would that reduce the E. coli, for example?
It's likely to reduce the E. coli because you haven't got those fecal sources from ruminant animals.
Mm.
My understanding, or from work I've done, would suggest that commercial vegetable production tends to have a higher nitrogen leaching loss or nitrogen loss than dairy, although obviously there's a range of activities within commercial vegetable production. There's also a significant range. But in general terms, and certainly this was considered in PC1, is that commercial vegetable production would have a higher risk of nitrogen loss than a dairy farm on the same area of land.
But you can see a situation where expanding CVP, it's not as simple as it is saying, oh, well, you're not doing your part, because you might actually be considerably reducing a contaminant like E. coli.
Yes, so you could absolutely reduce E. coli, mm, associated with ruminant sources. At the same time, you are likely to increase the risk of nitrogen sediment loss. And phosphorus is often associated with that sediment loss.
Sure, but you might considerably improve the E. coli situation, and the price you pay, as it were, is a modest increase in nitrogen, right?
Yes. So I think if you replace dairy farms with commercial vegetable production, I think all else being equal, what you would see is a likely reduction in E. coli, but likely an increase in monitoring stations nearby, a likely increase in nitrogen and possibly sediment.
And if we're comparing what happens now with what would happen under PC1, are you aware that at the moment there aren't the same sort of stringent controls for CVP that appear in PC1?
In terms of our current regional plan?
Yes.
That's my understanding, yes.
And so, don't you think that if going forward CVP is done in accordance with the control and discretionary rules, there's likely going to be less of an effect on water quality than occurs today?
Yes, if growers implement, and I know growers have invested a lot, particularly in sediment controls, if growers invest in appropriate mitigations compared to where they're at now, then yes, their environmental footprint will be reduced.
And that that reduction, that's something that the modelling didn't take into account, did it?
That's my understanding, yes.
So it's conservative in that regard, at least.
That's right, which is why we suggested it would be valuable for Port NZ to assess the degree to which mitigations could offset those potential increases.
Yes, but so when you say it's uncertain, that modelling's uncertain, it's uncertain in the direction of things could only be better than the modelling, isn't it?
Yes, I think that's reasonable. So we accept that the modelling currently predicts an increased nitrogen load in the river.
Mm. 4.5%.
By applying those mitigations, it would be less than that. I'm not sure to what extent those sorts of mitigations, how much of a change that could make.
No, but you can appreciate, as a scientist, that at least qualitatively, you see the logic of that conclusion.
Yes.
Thank you. I don't have any other questions.
Mr. Ferguson for River Iwi.
I just wanted to take you back a couple of steps to an issue that I think was first raised by my friend Ms. Tumai yesterday and followed up a little bit by my friend Ms. Longley this morning, and just clarify some aspects of the matter regarding the removal of Table 311.2 and then the method that's now proposed in 311.3.6 and the issue that was identified in the planning joint witness statement, which posed the question, what are the contaminants of most concern if any, in each subsection of the PC one area. You recollect that broad issue?
Yes.
And I think you indicated in answer, perhaps it was to Martin, was on the you cross-referenced to the farm plan, freshwater farm plan regulations, as I understood it, in that regard, and to, excuse me, I'll try and navigate my system here, to catchment context, challenges and values, that's correct?
Yes.
And so that's an obligation that exists on the regional councils, as I understand it, under Regulation 46 of those regulations, to collate existing information about catchment context, challenges and values. That's correct?
My understanding is.
And then farm operators under Regulation 9, when preparing freshwater farm plans, must have regard to those matters, if available, from the regional council. That's your understanding?
That's my understanding. I don't have detailed knowledge of the farm planning regulations.
And when one looks at the meaning of catchment context, challenges and values in Regulation 4 of those regulations, it says it includes the following information without limitation in relation to a local area. A, existing information on landforms, soil data, climate data, freshwater bodies, contaminants, sites that are significant to the community, significant species or ecosystems, that's correct, isn't it?
My understanding.
So it's quite a broad range of matters that are covered in that setting. And then there are also a range of other matters, including objectives, policies and rules that are relevant, tangata whenua, sites of cultural significance, other matters arising from the NPS freshwater management, that's correct?
Yes.
And then when I go and look at the proposed method 3.11.3.6, and I'm looking at the version that's attached to the legal submissions for the Regional Council, I see that that states that information, contextual information for farm environment plans, is in addition to the information required by the Resource Management Freshwater Farm Plans Regulations. That's correct?
Yeah, I haven't got it in front of me, but yes.
Right. So in addition to the matters that are described as, I've lost the phrase, but the CCCV, as you described it,
yes,
in the plans, then one has to provide, collate, make available and keep updated water management contextual information in relation to and interim target attribute states, current type attribute states, reduction required, and contaminants of most concern in each subcatchment. That's correct. That's one of the matters under that method that's required.
That's my understanding, yes.
And so I felt there was a little bit of circularity in the cross-referencing back to the values under the farm freshwater farm plan regulations in answer to the question that was posed by the planners about, you know, what are the contaminants of most concern. Given we've had a priority list in the table, we now don't have that. Your indication is that we can identify what are the contaminants of most concern in each subcatchment. That's your view?
That is my view, yes.
And I suppose my question, from asking this as a lawyer, and I suppose a planner would ask the same thing, and I suspect that might be what they were asking rather than what, was how will you determine those? Because it talks about collating information, but in my assessment, that information doesn't currently exist.
And I think there is a significant package of information that the Regional Council is looking to prepare and produce to assist landowners with their farm plans and the farm plan advisors. When we were considering that PC1 might have been implemented quite some time ago, we undertook a significant body of work to collate information about particular subcatchments, and that included much of the information that is now required under the Freshwater Farm Plan regulations, under what's called those CCCVs, but also provided a mini state of the environment, if you like, within each of those subcatchments. So those documents become a valuable resource in the rollout of those farm plans. It's fair to say that, as you pointed out, I'm not quite sure how landowners are going to digest and really fully take into account all of that detailed information. But in my opinion, that local information, both in terms of where the farm sits, the landscape context it sits in, the downstream values and issues, are all really important for developing an effective farm plan.
Yes. Well, if I go back to the method that I was referring to, 311.3.6, and the information to be collated by the regional council in relation to each of those subcatchments, is interim target attribute states, current attribute states, reduction required, and contaminants of most concern in each subcatchment. Does the regional council have that information available now? Or is there work to be done?
In terms of the interim targets and the current state, the answer to that is yes. So we've just produced a state of the environment report that has up-to-date current state information. In terms of the contaminants of most concern, I'm trying to think if we have that explicit, and I don't believe we do have that explicit information.
Because the table in 311.2 was an attempt at that at a broad level, wasn't it?
Yes, at a broad level, recognising that the local context, so some of those subcatchments are very large, and the local context might again be quite different, and I think that's part of some of the concerns people raised about it. But there is right from the very early stages, and Ms. Ong, we talked about the heat maps. That was an early attempt at trying to identify where in the catchment particular contaminants of concern existed. As I say, that's evolved over time into Table 311.2 and sort of beyond.
And are you confident that the Regional Council has the capacity and resourcing that this information will be in place at a time where landowners and others are required to engage with these obligations under PC1?
Yes, the information certainly exists. So we have that information. We can provide that information. I'm just not certain about exactly, as you said earlier, the how of how we provide that detailed technical information through to those implementing the farm plans.
Right. There's still a little bit of how, though, isn't there? I think you've acknowledged in terms of determining the contaminants of most concern in each subcatchment. There's still work to be done on that.
From a technical perspective, I would be confident that the scientists at WRC could answer that question right now, based on our recent State of the Environment report.
But you'd also agree, wouldn't you, that that type of information is critical if we're trying to make the first step changes that are required to improve
yes.
the North and Norwegian and the Waikato and Waipawa rivers?
Yes.
And if I could just then link you across to the earlier method 3.11.3.3, accounting system in monitoring. And excuse me while I find a piece of paper. There was, and I'm not sure if you have the Canning Joint Witness Statement before you.
Sorry, what?
The Canning Joint Witness Statement.
I haven't. I can grab it.
Grab it.
You want to give me a reference, please?
Oh, sorry. I'm not sure what tab.
Volume 401, the one of the narrow volumes, might be in front of you. Oh, no, it's the dark blue one, I think. Planning one, I think, is the last one on tab 7. Second to last one.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you.
my electronic index, unfortunately, it's a bit challenging at times. I wanted to take you to page 401.0131. It's using a common bundle reference. And you'll see there's a heading at the bottom of that page, numbered 0, comments on the entire plan, and then there's comments that appear on the top of the next page from a number of the planners. The plan must have a robust accounting framework to provide baseline information to track the cumulative effects of farming and seeding BP activities and point source discharges within a subcatchment or FMU, establish the allocation status of a subcatchment or FMU, and to assess whether we are on track to achieve the target attribute states for each subcatchment and the main spend. Do you agree that that's critical?
Absolutely.
And that is the accounting system that method 311.33 is referring to, isn't it, when you're saying Waikato Regional Council will establish and operate a publicly available accounting system and monitoring in each freshwater management unit and subcatchment, including and assess out a range of matters.
Yes.
And it's critical, isn't it, because of the exchange you had with my friend in relation to vegetables, as he put it, but also in relation to all land use within the catchment. It's critical because we are managing at limits at the moment, aren't we? We've got zero room for slippage if we've got a target of improving. That's correct.
That's my understanding, yes.
And that's why you referred to, in absolute terms, we've got pass fail. So any percentage degradation or additional degradation is moving backwards, not forwards. That's your position.
Yes.
And so I think, and this was a matter that His Honour Judge Williams raised, I think, on day one, which was the practical reality is, in order to be able to provide for expansion of CBP, let alone potential development of Tangata Whenua or ancestral land, it's critical that we have an accounting system that is able to identify that headroom has been created so that there is scope for such development in a way that cumulatively does not result in a degradation. That's correct?
Yes. And if I may say, we do, I think, a really good job of monitoring water, the water quality, so the receiving environment. The information we haven't had access to is the detailed information of what's happening at the property scale and the farm environment plans and other methods will enable the Regional Council to essentially build an accounting framework that has that property scale information so we understand what changes are being made, how much further boats might have to go, what that means, what that might be what the predicted effects might be for the river.
But the council is on track to develop this accounting system that will allow that level of detail to be assessed and analysed in order that we can then identify, and presumably that the council can then make decisions about whether an extension of CVP does in fact result in a 0.1 or a 1% or no increase in degradation, and similarly that overall, in terms of the development of Tangata Whenua ancestral land, there's capacity, while still moving forward, to allow that development to occur. You accept that's correct?
Yes.
And you, that is on track?
Yes, there's some outstanding question in my mind about how to what extent regional councils will have access to detailed information contained in farm environment plans. So my understanding is that regional councils will be able to access that information, and I consider that information critical for that accounting framework.
So is that something that this plan should be ensuring that information is able to flow to the regional council as well?
I'm not an expert on the freshwater farm plan regulations, but I have a question in my mind about whether those regulations enable regional councils to incorporate that data to the extent that a scientist like myself would like to be able to use in terms of our state of the environment reporting.
And so if there was a gap in that regard, then that's something that we should be addressing up front in this plan. Given that we can go further than the farm plan regulations.
Yeah, but as I say, it's a question in my mind. I don't know. As I say, I'm not an expert in those regulations. My concerns might not be well founded.
And somebody else may be able to assist us on that later in this hearing. Thank you very much. I've no further questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Majuri, any questions for this witness?
Yep, that one works as well.
From watching the science. Well, this might be a repeat of yesterday with Mr. McCullough in terms of whether double mic up, whether to ask these questions to you or to another witness. So, as you would have heard from Council for the Council, there was reference to the policy framework and the proposed plan change around the concept of betterment. Are you aware of that?
Yes.
In terms of the methodology around that, in terms of how it applies and whether it applies, etc., is it something I discern with you or with someone else?
If you wanted to know about potential improvements in the Waikato River and the wider catchment as a result of PC1, I'm happy to address those questions.
Let me ask you this question. We can take it further, whether it's you or someone else. Assuming that regime comes to pass in the final version after this process, and questions as to betterment arise on a land parcel basis within the regional context, how does one undertake the math around it?
It's a really good question. I think it relates to the previous conversation around accounting.
Is that you or someone else?
Well, I'm happy to make comment on that, if that's all right. But it does come back to the extent of improvement in practice of individual landowners, whether that be through different activity status and appropriate or associated controls, or via various national regulations for stock exclusion, etc., things in PC1 and the farm plan. So the extent to which there will be betterment at that property scale is tied up with the extent to which individual landowners implement actions to improve their practice. And we can expect, and I think Mr. Brockstock will is probably the best person to talk about the efficacy of farm plans, but we know that there will be a range of levels of improvement where some landowners will undertake significant or more significant works than others. So in aggregate, once we can understand the levels of change that are coming through those farm plans, we can estimate the reductions in contaminants along the river.
Keeping it at the high level and to indulge in one of those wonderful hypotheticals, but again to assist the court with the implementation operation of PC1, if this is the regime that comes to pass, how temporally does the council deal with an individual land parcel which is a relatively small percentage of a wider catchment on an instant basis? In other words, or put another way, where there's a resource intensification and there's reports that go with it, how is the system going to accommodate those sorts of calculations?
I think, there is a real challenge in how we capture that information and utilise it in the accounting framework. There's likely to be a wealth of information collected in that instance.
Is it fair to say, and this isn't a criticism but more trying to get to the nub of it, that PC1 in its current form doesn't provide those answers as yet?
In terms of the how of...
It's sort of calculation you and I have been talking about.
Yeah, so one of the... And this is an organisational issue to resolve, is how do we ensure that information collected by some parts of council is fully integrated into the accounting framework, the accounting system, which might be overseen by science, for example, or a different part of council. So there is a challenge which I'm certainly aware of, and others within council are aware of that challenge of having an appropriate flow of information. And to your question, I don't think PC1 necessarily addresses that organisational issue.
Does or it doesn't? I think you've been clear it doesn't.
No, I don't think it does. In my understanding, it doesn't.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else, any other party present online who wishes to...
Yes, Your Honour, Graham Pennell here.
Mr. Pennell, I wondered if you were still here. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Your Honour. My questions are around setback distances from the beds of streams. Sorry, am I on video or just on voice?
Yeah, you're just on audio at the moment.
But yes, that's a bit. Pardon?
You're very clear. We can hear you clearly.
Oh, good. Thank you. Sorry about the lack of visual, but that may be a good thing. My issues are around stream setbacks. Perhaps we just need to start at where Schedule C talks about setbacks in such cases being at least 3 metres from the outer edge of a bed of a stream. Just to make sure we are on the same page, I wonder if you can just describe to me what you understand by a bed.
Just looking for Schedule C. Mr. Pennell, I'll give you my answer as a stream ecologist. Waterways will tend to have a defined channel. I'm giving this my viewpoint as a scientist, because I understand that there are likely to be legal or planning definitions as well that others more qualified might need to consider. The channel of a waterway tends to be able to be defined by a number of factors, including obviously the presence of water, but that's not always the case. Also, the substrate within that channel and the presence or absence of terrestrial vegetation in that channel. Those are some of the key factors. So I'm not sure if that helps or if that answers your question, Mr. Pennell, but
Look, it does, thank you. I need to tell you what my understanding of the planning requirements are, and maybe one of our legal friends can confirm or deny. And that is, there doesn't seem to be any definition in PC1 as such, but the regional plan defines bed in the same terms as the RMA does, which is one of those cheap little ways of definition, and that's at the fullest flow without overtopping banks. So essentially, bed, to your surprise, probably means the top of the stream bank.
Now that would be consistent with my understanding. So what you're talking about there is what's termed a bank full discharge, and depending on how frequently that bank full discharge occurs, you may or may not have vegetation on the edge of the stream bank. But I think that's consistent with what I was saying. If I might also, go ahead.
Okay, look, we're on the same page, so that's great. So I now refer to paragraph 70 of your rebuttal evidence, where you say there will be stream sections where narrow setbacks provide adequate protection, and other sections where wider setbacks could be more beneficial. Could you expand on that, please?
Yes, absolutely. So my general view is that stock exclusion from waterways is a universal good practice. So there's always going to be benefit accruing from excluding stock from waterways. The benefit in terms of the extent of setback provided, it's my view that no one sort of distance of setback is going to be appropriate in all situations. If you are looking to mitigate contaminant loss from land to water, there will be situations where a wider setback is appropriate, because you can capture and filter more of the contaminant pathways. And then there'll be situations where a narrow setback might be more appropriate, because the contaminant flow paths are such that you don't need a wide buffer. So that's sort of my overall view. I guess in terms of sort of expert caucusing on setbacks, in essence, there needs to be a minimum setback defined, and that minimum setback is what tends to be the matter of quite a bit of discussion and debate. And a number of studies have looked at what an appropriate setback might be. But when you go onto a farm and on the ground, my view is that you are likely to have more effective contaminant control if you have some ability to modify the amount of setback you have.
Okay, thank you. So you're suggesting that Schedule C minimum standards should be a de facto minimum, but that there is a need for tailored solutions in the farm environment plan to have larger setbacks for various reasons where filtering is a effective practice, for instance.
Yes, from a technical perspective, yes, I think some flexibility and making sure that, well, not making sure, but trying to maximise the benefits of that riparian setback will often require some local decision making. And as Mr. Matheson and I were talking about yesterday, it would seem counterproductive if adherence to setbacks was to create other significant adverse effects, such as major erosion or sediment runoff. So I think it's yes, I do think there's a need for tailored solutions.
Thank you. I guess it's fairly obvious that in rolling country there's a lot of concentration of flow, and with those circumstances, setbacks and filtering will be pretty ineffective. Can we turn our mind to floodplain situations? Have you read the joint witness statement from the farm systems people?
No, I haven't.
Okay. In there is a diagram of how floodplains form up, and you're probably familiar with the method of floodplain deposition, whereby streams, when they overflow and flood, tend to deposit more material beside the streams than further away. And over a period of time and repeated episodes, low levees, mini stop banks in effect, form up. In such cases, the runoff from the floodplain then was diverted round behind and is then concentrated and discharged by way of natural swales or drains or other such methods. Where those natural levees are, there's actually no runoff from the plain, in which case would you agree that setbacks in such places can be very minimal without having any adverse effects?
Yes, insofar as if you're wanting to provide riparian buffers to filter, if that area of the waterway, the flow paths are not directed into that part of the stream, then yes, I'd agree that your riparian buffer will be a wide riparian buffer may be ineffective. There is also the situation to consider around the potential damage of the banks by stock. We've got a very narrow setback. And I think, again, Mr. Matheson talked about this yesterday in terms of stock pacing along the fence lines. As I say, there's a need for tailored situations, but I agree with the the scenario you've raised for us. Thank you.
Thank you for that. That's all we've got to ask. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pennell. Anyone else? Any other party? Any re-examination?
No, thank you, sir.
No.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Scales. Look, I've just got a couple of questions, I suppose, and I'm trying to stay in my lane. But if I can I ask you to turn to paragraph 87 of your rebuttal evidence.
That's in relation to
the paragraph starting further to the subject,
yes,
of water quality,
yep,
degradation.
Yes.
You've addressed this to some degree with Ms. Carruthers earlier, but I just wanted to take you back to this. Mr. Trevelka asked you to address evidence on behalf of parties proposing a less restrictive activity status for land use conversions of the type regulated by 3.11.4.9. Now, Mr. Conway yesterday suggested that this is the avenue for tangata whenua in order to seek land change use. Now, you say at paragraph 88 of that same rebuttal document that I consider pine to dairy conversion to be major intensification that is likely to result in significant increases in the risk of contaminant losses to water. So, in a situation where tangata whenua are looking to change the lands which they might receive by way of settlement, for example, of forestry, is, and this is a matter which I know Ms. Robson expresses in her evidence on behalf of CNI, she's concerned that there's the reality of the ability to seek a land change consent, and looking at your comment there, is negligible. Would that be fair?
So from a water quality perspective, if there was significant areas of forest to dairy farming conversions occurring in the Upper Waikato catchment, we would expect to see increases in contaminant levels, and particularly nitrogen. And as was the case for CVP, that would potentially lead to us not achieving targets in the river.
No, I understand that.
Without appropriate mitigation of those.
Well, I suppose that's what I'm getting to, because the proposed feed chain talks at Objective 4 in Policy 18 about giving tangata whenua the opportunity to utilise and manage their land, particularly in situations where they haven't had that prior opportunity. And so I suppose coming back to your comment, I guess at paragraph 88 of your rebuttal, it does seem to me that there may be some force to Ms. Robson's concern that if you take your position on board, the likelihood of a approval of a land change is minimal. Or perhaps is it fair to say that without mitigation of other areas by individual farmers,
yeah,
that without that mitigation, that there's likely to be minimal opportunity for that to occur?
I think, and I cover this in my evidence, one of the primary drivers for Plan Change 1 was significant expansion of dairy farming, so a conversion from pine forest to dairy farming in the Upper Waikato catchment,
yeah,
in the period from 2000 to 2010 or thereabouts. And concerns that our current Waikato Regional Plan doesn't provide appropriate levels of control on that land use change.
Mm.
My understanding is that what PC1 is providing is a pathway for intensification, but under relatively strict controls.
Yeah, so you're saying it's providing conceptually the ability for intensification, e.g. by virtue of a land change. Is that what you're saying?
If I got the planning wrong, and Erwin can correct me.
Well, I won't be doing that, but...
But the... So in seeking to control land use intensification,
yep,
there is also the recognition that parties will want to intensify their land use.
Yes.
And that PC1 needs to provide pathways or a pathway for those parties. My understanding is that level of control is such that the parties would have to show that there is no net increase in contaminants.
Yes, but you appreciate
you're wrong with that.
Māori don't have the ability, or some of the whenua don't have the ability to control the extent of detriment within the area. That's completely out of their control. But they're dependent on the extent of betterment in order for them to be able to utilise their land. Is that fair? I mean, is that a fair assessment?
I guess the question of how you would convert an area of pine forest to dairy farm and do it in such a way as not to increase levels of the four contaminants, I agree, is challenging. But it's not, I wouldn't say it's impossible. It may be particularly challenging. This for context, this is a conversation that occurred in the Rotorua catchment.
So, yes.
And the idea that you know, you could have further intensification in the Rotorua catchment and still achieve the nitrogen loading limits to the lake by careful arrangement of land uses in the landscape, by essentially converting some areas and providing mitigations in other areas to offset those increases.
Yeah, I suppose
so
that last comment.
It's possible, I think, for intensification to occur while not increasing levels of contaminants, but I would agree it's likely to be quite challenging.
Right. And so for Tangata Whenua, if they are to be able to utilise lands which they receive, in order for them to comply or try to comply with Policy 5B, for example, which provides for any increase in diffuse discharge of nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment, etc., from the property, there needs to be a compensation by reduction of diffuse discharge of those contaminants not increasing. It's possible but highly unlikely on their own specific area, then that's a fair reflection of what you've just said.
Yes. So it might require not only changes from, and I'm just sort of thinking hypothetically here, it might require changes both in terms of pine forest to dairy conversion, but also perhaps areas of less productive hill country conversion into forest, for example, which would lead to a net reduction potentially. So it would be challenging. I agree.
All right. Thank you. That's helpful.
Any questions?
Well, if you don't want to take a break, then maybe we'll take the lunch break now and come back for the questions from the commissioners following this. Dr. Scatterbrook, the good news is that we're not cross-examining you. We're just asking for information. You're no longer under cross-examination. So you're welcome to
talk to people.
Obviously, if anybody says, make sure you say this to the question. You say, well, I'll answer honestly. But other than that, no, you're welcome to go back and join the team. And we'll return at 2:15, everyone.